Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the show today.
You know, according to National Geographic magazine, there are only about 720 mountain gorillas left on our planet today. Despite years of education and conservation efforts, these magnificent primates are still being slaughtered at an alarming rate. Today's guests spent 2 years in a remote village working closely with local trackers to save these endangered animals. His name, as I said, is Dr. Thor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist, writer, and award-winning poet. He's traveled the globe studying everything from primates and vultures to the pollination of the rainforest trees. He now lives in the San Juan Islands, right up here in the Pacific Northwest, and is joining us today to share his insights. And his new book is called The Impenetrable Forest, My Gorilla Years in Uganda. Thor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks very much.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you called in and managed to touch base with you because the topic of your book was so interesting to me. I learned such a lot reading your book, and it was just a really great read.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. So I want to tell our listeners that you actually went and spent 2 years out with the gorillas, but that was in 1993, right?
That's right. I was there in the mid-90s for just over 2 years.
And you joined the Peace Corps. Why did you join the Peace Corps?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd love to be able to say that my work with the gorillas was part of some master plan that I'd had since I was a kid and had been reading primatology textbooks as a child and taking notes on my family. But as a matter of fact, it was really blind luck. I joined the Peace Corps because I wanted to work in Africa. And as a young biologist, I had no particular experience with gorillas at that time. As far as I know, the Peace Corps looked at my resume and said, well, he's a primate. He must be qualified. And so they are the ones who made the connection and assigned me to a new national park there to work with local trackers, developing an ecotourism program based on mountain gorillas.
Now, what did you think when you were going through your interview process? Because they were asking you questions like, you know, how do you like being isolated? How do you feel about living 17 miles from the nearest village or 17 kilometers?
Yeah, it started to dawn on me that they had plans for me that were a little bit different than the typical Peace Corps assignment. Although the Peace Corps does do more and more natural resource-based work around the world, I certainly did not have an expectation that I would be assigned to a mountain gorilla project, but that's, in fact, just what they had in store for me.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about the program that you were sent out there to do. You weren't sent out there to do scientific research like Diane Fossey did. We all, you know, most of us have heard of Diane Fossey and her studies with gorillas. You were sent out there to habituate the gorillas. For what reasons?
That's right. They had recently created a new national park called the Impenetrable Forest, Bwindi Impenetrable Forest, and the idea was to develop an ecotourism program based on mountain gorilla tracking, based on taking in small groups of visitors on a daily basis to see the gorillas in the wild. So that was just getting underway when I started, and my duties included habituating gorillas, getting them used to people so that, in fact, we could take in visitors to see them. The concept really behind ecotourism with the mountain gorillas is to try to create an economic incentive for their conservation, for the conservation of gorillas and the forest in which they live. These gorillas, as you mentioned in your intro, are down to about 720 individuals living in two populations that are completely surrounded by very dense human populations. So the pressure on those little patches of forest is quite intense. And it's an area where the income level is quite low, and it's a challenging place for folks to live. So they have to have some kind of a tangible reason for conservation. And ecotourism can help make that connection by providing jobs and a real economic incentive at the local level and also the national level for conservation. And that's what we were really trying to achieve.
Okay. I was going to ask you, as a conservationist, how you felt about that, how you felt about ecotourism. But listening to what you just said, it sounds as though you feel that was a good solution, maybe the only solution to save the gorillas.
Well, you know, I think if you sat down with a whole room full of biologists, or really a room full of anyone interested in primate conservation, and asked, you know, what would be the ideal way to preserve these animals, we might say, hey, listen, there are 720 of these creatures left, these marvelous gorillas, and there are, you know, 6 or 7 billion people on the planet. Can't we just set aside these last bits of habitat and leave these gorillas unmolested? But unfortunately, with the pressures on those bits of forest and with the challenges that people face in their daily lives in that region and the needs that they have for firewood, charcoal, for simply a place to plant crops, without some real tangible economic incentive, those patches of forest would, and the gorillas they contain, would most likely disappear. So I think the question really boils down to, will the gorillas survive without something like ecotourism helping to encourage their conservation?
Right. And I should say, because National Geographic earlier this month, along with several other scientific journals, came out with the news that they just found a secret colony of lowland gorillas, but we are talking about mountain gorillas here.
That's right. That's right. There are two species of gorillas. There are western gorillas and eastern gorillas, and they're separated by a wide expanse of rainforest in the Congo Basin that's uninhabited by gorillas. And the theory is that during the ice ages, when so much of the world's moisture was trapped in the polar ice caps, the tropical areas in places became quite dry, and so that rainforest shrank into pockets, one in the east, one in the west, that were separated by savanna-type country that was uninhabited by gorillas. And even though things are moister now and the rainforest has grown back across that central band of Africa, the gorillas have not recolonized some of that area, and these separate western and eastern populations evolved into separate species.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how old were you when you went out there, Thor? You looked like a fairly young man on the photographs that I saw.
That's right. I was, let's see, I would have been 23 when I arrived in Uganda. That's right.
So what were your first impressions arriving there? Obviously, major culture shock over the first few days.
That's right. There was plenty of that. There was plenty of that. I had studied abroad in Kenya, which is right next door to Uganda. And so I had some expectations of what the landscape and the culture was like, but still to arrive straight from the States and be dropped into the midst of an African village was quite a culture shock for me.
Yeah.
I remember when I left the States, I told my folks that I was really trying to keep my expectations and goals quite simple, but just to make good friends and really share something of my culture with those friends that I made in Uganda and really have real connections there. And in the Peace Corps, they also encourage that. They remind folks that, hey, you know, the Peace Corps may have really a three-pronged goal, but two-thirds of that, sharing of your culture and learning of all other cultures, you accomplish just by being there in your village. And the third goal of transferring knowledge is almost icing on the cake. If you can accomplish that, that's batting 1,000. But two-thirds really is just your presence in those villages.
Right. You said when you arrived there, you all of the volunteers were together to begin with. You said there was everyone there from potheads and born-again Christians, poets and welders, Rush Limbaugh fans and lesbians. The age group range was from 22 through 70. And one of the biggest challenges was bridging your own American cultural gaps.
That's true. It's a very diverse group of people that end up in the Peace Corps. And we had a marvelous group when I arrived. And as you say, just a very diverse bunch of folks with different backgrounds. And so I think being put in that position of this incredible shared experience of being in Uganda, it put us together in a way that allowed our bonds to grow quickly and to bridge things that would have been much more challenging in the States. I don't think you ever would have gotten a group like that together in the same room back
right.
home, but here we all were having similar cultural experiences in Uganda, and it really helped cement those friendships.
Yeah. Now, when you were first there, you went through some kind of training. What kind of training was that? Did they was it general Peace Corps training, or were you looking at, you know, hey, this is how you need to chat with the guerrillas up there?
Right. You know, it was a general Peace Corps training. We had about 2.5 months of training, and that included language training, it included cultural training, things about Ugandan history and the diversity of cultural groups in Uganda. There are more than 40 languages and different tribes.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was quite a fascinating immersion. But at that time, there was no training for me really specific to guerrillas. In fact, I didn't know really what I would be doing until quite a long time after I arrived, when they gathered us all around a big map of the country, and the director of the Peace Corps was pointing out villages and telling people where they'd be spending the next 2 years, and she gestured down to this roadless area in the southwestern part of the country and said, "Tora, we're sending you to the middle of nowhere." So it was really only at that point that I learned I'd be working with mountain gorillas.
And your job title was natural resource manager.
So. Yeah, that's right. It was so vague, it could have been anything. So, of course, then I began immediately looking for anything I could find about gorillas. But in the Peace Corps Uganda library, the only book that had anything to do with gorillas was Michael Crichton's Congo, which was a story of these crazy albino gorillas racing around the jungle attacking people. So it wasn't really very encouraging, but I did read every word.
Not much help to you when you have to go tracking, though, right?
No, not exactly.
So how long did it take you to acclimate to the culture? I know one of the things that shocked you, or you didn't really, you felt uncomfortable about, was how women would kneel before men or bow to the floor when men entered the room as a formal gesture.
Yes, and that custom still occurs in some tribes, and in the tribe where I was staying during that training process, I lived with a fairly traditional family, and that was an absolute shock to have children and women kneel as a form of greeting, or if someone were bringing you a cup of tea or a soda, these things were very, very unusual, and it took quite a while to grow accustomed to that and to make connections across that, well, particularly with women, across that gender gap, to get through that formality until one could have conversations, say, with the host mother of the family where I lived. It took time. It just took longer to bridge that gap. But by the end, certainly Susan and I had developed a very nice friendship.
Now, did you live with the host family all of the time, or was this just when you were in the main town?
I lived with a host family during that 2.5 months of training,
right.
When I was in the town there. And once I was out working actually at my job for those 2 years in the impenetrable forest, then I lived on my own.
So describe to us, I saw a photograph of the house that you lived in the impenetrable forest. Describe what that was like to us, how isolated you were.
Well, it was quite an isolated spot. It really was. We were literally at the end of the road, a road that circled all the way around this patch of forest and stopped right near the border with Congo. And so the road literally stopped right at my driveway, and I was living in a mud hut that had been a part of a very tiny church compound at the edge of this village, at the edge of the forest. And the park had purchased some property right at the edge of the forest there to create the new tourism center and park headquarters right on the edge of the forest. So it was very remote. We had, at that time, one radio and a mud hut and a borrowed motorcycle, and that was pretty much the park infrastructure. And so we were working with local folks that we hired, some trackers and some guides, and my work took me then into the forest on a daily basis, working with those people and training the guides to be able to take tourists in when we started that as well. So it was quite a remote place, it really was.
Now, this surprised me because you said there that the trackers were actually afraid of the gorillas, and one of the roles in your job was to actually make sure they actually got to the gorilla and just didn't go up the hill and say, yeah, everything's fine.
Yeah. When I arrived, they had begun the habituation process, and one of the groups, the gorilla groups, was coming along quite famously. You know, I worked primarily with two mountain gorilla families, the first of which, Mubare group, we sort of thought of as a traditional gorilla family with a lead silverback, and there were six adult females and six juveniles and infants. And his name in the local language was Ruhondeza, which means the one who sleeps a lot, and it's after a sort of Rip Van Winkle type local story. And then there was another group that I worked with called Katendjeri group, and we really became fond of them, but we did think of them as our dysfunctional gorilla family. There was a lead silverback and then five other adult males and only one female and one juvenile. So working with that group and all the testosterone racing around amongst all those males was quite a challenge. And indeed, the trackers for Katendjeri group had some well-deserved fear of those gorillas with all of the activity going on there. So one of the things that I did was spend a lot of time with them just for that reason, to make sure we were actually getting in and spending time close to the animals and that they weren't just having lunch up the hill and coming back down again.
Right, and this was quite a trek. I mean, you say just up the hill, but I mean, this was quite a trek for you to go up the mountain. And I remember reading in one spot that you said you wished the trackers would wake up with a hangover so they'd be slow in the morning. They sure seem to like that banana beer a lot.
Yes, there was a great deal of banana beer in the village, and it's sort of fermented banana juice, quite an interesting beverage, an acquired taste, but one that had certainly been acquired by some of the trackers. So after market day, really, it was one of the great days for me in those early weeks because, gosh, the guys would be a little hungover, and it would be much easier for me to keep up with them on those steep slopes. And I have to say, one would feel pretty ridiculous as well when I first got there with my hiking boots and my Gore-Tex jacket and all of this rigmarole, and here these fellows are in their flip-flops and just zooming along these trails while I'm slipping around like a pinball.
Yeah, amazing. Now, you say that one of the reasons that the government focused in on the gorillas was also to save the impenetrable forest, because that was obviously at risk too.
Right.
It's now one of the few protected rainforests in Africa to have highland and lowland habitats. And there's quite an array of wildlife in there.
That's right. And we often talk about in conservation biology the idea of an umbrella species. So an animal or a plant or some key conservation species that you can use that will protect a whole range of other things underneath its umbrella. If, in fact, you're conserving habitat that will save the mountain gorilla, you're going to, by that fact, save habitat for all kinds of other creatures. So in the impenetrable forest, we had forest elephants. We had, 320 different species of trees, over 300 different birds, more than 300 kinds of butterflies, as well as many other primate species. We had monkeys and baboons and chimpanzees. We had some interesting nocturnal primates as well, and various forest antelopes. So by protecting the gorillas and saving that forest, the conservation effort bears a lot of other fruit.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Thor Hansen. His book is The Impenetrable Forest, My Gorilla Years in Uganda. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Vicky St. Clair and wanted to let you know about Book Talk, a weekly podcast brought to you by Conversations Live. In Book Talk, we'll be reviewing books from the eclectic to the banned to the challenging and, of course, to the easy and fun summer beach read. You can download Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com under the podcast section of the site. If you'd like to be a guest reviewer for Book Talk, call me, Vicky, at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest is, I've been saying his name Thor, but it's really Tor, Dr. Tor Hansen. His book, The Impenetrable Forest, My Guerrilla Years in Uganda. So, Tor, let's look at some of the guerrilla experiences that you had. What was it like for you when you're climbing up that hill for the very first time and you're getting closer and closer, the tracks are getting fresher and fresher? What's going through your mind?
Boy, well, I'll tell you, quite, as you know, as a biologist and a sort of all-around eco-nerd, you know, the opportunity to see animals like that, even once in the wild, you know, was just a lifetime thrill. And so something that struck me from that very first visit even was that this was going to be a vocation for 2 years and not just a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And so that first day that we went to see the gorillas, I'll just never forget getting in closer and seeing this dark shadow sort of separate itself from the deeper shadows of the forest and move across our field of vision. And when we saw, it was Ruhondeza was the first of the large males that I encountered. And he looked up, and I was looking at him, and we both sort of adjusted our heads so that we got a clear look at one another through the vegetation and made eye contact. And to feel that down the line I might see recognition as well as just the calm intelligence of that animal in his eyes was really a profound feeling. Mm.
Did you manage to keep your trackers, or did they bail on you at that point?
You know, the trackers were really terrific, and I have to say their skills in the forest were remarkable. You know, when I first arrived, I think, you know, they felt, well, this guy must be a really great tracker, and they didn't understand it at that point. I couldn't track a gorilla in a bathtub. I didn't know a first thing about it, so everything I learned was from them. But they're able to discern a leaf and twig trail through the forest that you can't even imagine, that you would never notice those subtle clues. But they suffered, you know, in the beginning from this horrible combination of being really good at tracking these big animals, and yet the better they did their job, the closer they got to these these animals that they were afraid of. So quite a job challenge for them.
And how did you begin to habituate them?
Well, habituation is a process that's an exercise in patience as much as anything else. What you do is follow the gorillas on a daily basis so you have an idea of where they are, and you track them and try to find a distance at which they're comfortable. At a distance, you know, in the beginning might be 100 yards or more. You try to find a distance where they will continue what they're doing and not be alarmed by your presence. But, of course, in the very beginning, there is no distance they're going to be comfortable at. They're either going to charge at you or they're going to run away. And so, really, you just have to keep at it day after day until they begin to realize that your presence is benign, and then you shorten that distance over time until you're within a distance where you can see the animals but not be risking the transmission of disease to them. So we tried never to get closer than 15 feet or 5 meters roughly from the animals.
I was going to bring that up because they did studies of the in the 70s in Rwanda, and they had generations of gorillas growing up in close contact with humans, and they are now paying that price of disease if they haven't already paid it, right?
There's the disease risk. You know, we share more than 98% of the same genetic makeup with these animals, and our physiology is quite similar. Our bodies are quite similar, and we're susceptible to similar diseases, particularly respiratory infections. And so that distance is important for preventing the transmission of things through the air. And you're right, in places in Rwanda where the gorillas grew up in closer proximity to people, they're much more accustomed to a closer distance. And during those days, I should say when Diane Fossey was doing her work, the idea of disease transmission was not as strong in people's minds. And so she had much closer contact, and those gorillas then grew up being accustomed to being near people. So there is actually a great program out there now called the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, and they have a vet on staff in that part of the world working on mountain gorilla issues. If there's something that comes up that the vets feel was caused by humans, they will intervene. So if a gorilla is caught in a snare, they would intervene and remove the snare, or if the gorilla has scabies or some other disease that seems that it directly caught from humans, they would intervene. But they don't intervene. Their principles are very good. They don't intervene, for example, if there's an altercation among gorillas and a gorilla is injured naturally. That kind of thing they let play out, and they only try to treat injuries or to correct things that were caused by human contact.
Now, in your role, how did you get to habituate them without getting so close to them that they want to wander up to people, tourists, and start poking them?
You know, the real challenge, Vicki, is when you get these youngsters that do grow up seeing people on a daily basis. The adult gorillas are more likely to keep their distance unless they're charging or doing something dramatic, in which case they might come closer. Those 15-foot rules, it's easier to enforce them with tourists than to convince the gorillas to follow those rules at times.
True.
but the youngsters, who really have no fear particularly, as they get a little older, they become quite curious. And so what we found ourselves doing, if we saw a toddler heading in our direction, would be to shake vegetation or do little things that would annoy the little gorilla so it would back off and learn to keep that distance. But you don't want to actually terrify the little gorilla, or suddenly you have the whole group charging down upon you. So it was a bit of a balancing act. But we always did try to instill in them some kind of response that they would try to maintain that distance.
Two things that really surprised me reading your story. Gorillas don't sleep in the same nest two nights in a row, at least very rarely do they do that.
Right.
And then they don't use tools in the wild.
No, they don't. That's a good question. Their habits are to be on the move, because they do consume large quantities of vegetation. They have a digestive tract that's very similar to ours. And so they're inefficient in terms of eating leaves and making a living off of eating leaves and twigs and some fruit. You can imagine if all we ate was green salad, we'd have to have quite a lot of that to keep going. So they eat huge quantities of vegetation and fruit, and they need to keep moving to find that. So they just make a nest wherever they decide to spend the night. And each animal makes its own nest. And so that's one of the ways you can follow them and even do counts of gorillas, do a census in the wild, is by counting the number of night nests.
Mm.
And remind me, Vicky, what the second part of that question was, about tools?
Well, yeah, but they don't use tools in the wild.
Yeah, now the tool use that we've seen in primates is primarily with chimpanzees, another of the great ape species, and we've noticed a number of different tool uses there, from fishing for termites with twigs to breaking open nuts with stone anvils and things. But in gorillas, we haven't observed that kind of tool use. In fact, if they want to eat termites, which they'll do, they're more likely to just break apart the termite mound and get some termites rather than carefully fishing around with a twig. So tool use in gorillas has not been observed in the wild.
Oh, interesting. I just assumed because chimps did it that all primates use tools. That's really interesting. When you're living so closely with them, did you see the film The Grizzly Bear Man with Timothy Treadwell?
Oh, I did see that, yes.
And how he got so integrated. I mean, he thought he was part of the bear family, I think. How do you avoid that happening when you're on the side of a mountain with these creatures and, you know, they look at you with their big brown eyes? How do you avoid to start, you know, start not looking at them as though they're becoming pets, I guess,
right,
is the question.
That's a very good question. Well, a part of it is the very real fear that we had of disease transmission, and so always trying to maintain our distance and keep the tourists at a distance. Mm. But certainly one develops great affection for these creatures, and I came to know very quickly that they have individual personalities just the same way people do, and so you start to learn them as individuals, and then that affection and that bond can grow. And there were times even when we saw the gorillas, you know, responding to us as individuals. And, you know, it's a two-way street. There's one incident I can remember very strongly where there was an altercation going on between two sort of the more pugnacious males in the Catendigeri family. And oftentimes when that would happen, that pressure would look for the easiest release valve, and that would be the smaller primates in the region, which was the humans that were sitting there watching it. So sometimes two gorillas having a tussle would turn around and charge at us as to sort of relieve that tension. And just as that happened, yeah, exactly. Just as that happened, one of the other males came in between us and diverted that attention to him and dispelled that tension immediately. And so we did, you know, after some months with the animals, come to wonder, gosh, who is habituating whom here? They are responding to us as primates that they're familiar with. So it was quite a moment.
Mm. You developed a favorite, right?
Yeah, I sure did.
Tell us about him.
Oh, Macaulay was a young male. Oh, he was a teenager. He was a punk in the Catendigeri group. He was the self-appointed watchdog for that group, and any time there was something going on, he was right in the middle of it. He was a blackback male, what we call a blackback, who was approaching full size, but not yet old enough to be developing the silvery hairs of a silverback. So he was coming of age, really. He was a late adolescent, and he would get into all kinds of things. If we went in with a new person during that habituation phase, if we took in, say, a relief tracker, say one of the trackers went on vacation and we'd get just one of the regular anti-poaching rangers to go with us to keep our complement of people, Macaulay would pick that person out, come around from behind and charge at the new guy just to tease them. So he was a real punk and certainly one of my favorite individuals there.
Do you have a favorite memory when you look back now on that time there? Do you have a favorite incident?
Boy, it's hard to pick out a single favorite. That's why I had to write a book about it. But certainly a lot of the time with the gorillas, and then also some of the wonderful friendships that I developed with the trackers and the guides and other folks there in the village. Provided a whole host of memories, and I'm still in touch with many of those people, which is very rewarding.
Mm. Now, let's look at some numbers, because when you went out there, I think there were 300, is that correct?
Yeah, well, the numbers now for the mountain gorillas are for two populations. One is Buindia Impenetrable Forest, where I worked, which is within, basically entirely within Uganda. It's right on the border with Congo, but the forest that had been on the Congo side has been cleared. But just about 25 miles to the south are the Virunga volcanoes, which are shared between Uganda, Rwanda, and Congo. And that is another population of mountain gorillas, another patch of high elevation forest. So within the Buindi forest where I work, the impenetrable forest, were at that time between 280 and 300 gorillas, and to the south, another 300 to 350 in the Virungas. And the most recent census has shown an increase in both populations, which is very, very gratifying. So now we think the total is about 720.
Mm, that's great. But we still have poaching going on, right? And you actually write of one of those incidences in your book when five gorillas were massacred just for the sake of grabbing an infant gorilla.
That's right. We still have poaching incidents that occur, and the most recent or the most famous recent incident occurred just about a year ago in Congo, where at least 10 gorillas in several incidents were slaughtered, not even for trophies or to steal infants for the pet trade, but really as a retaliation against park authorities by, at least it's strongly suspected, by people involved in an illegal charcoal industry that was taking place and continues within the park there. And they were killing gorillas, in effect, to send a message to back off and let them continue their illegal activities there.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets about your time at Buindi? Do you have any thoughts, you know, I wish this had been different, or I wish we had accomplished, you know, something else?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say it's not a regret per se, but I do remember that, you know, when I left that forest, I had gotten to know the people in the village and the people in the community so well that there were some opportunities that, had I stayed, I could have pursued that I knew wouldn't probably happen if I left, in terms of expanding some gorilla habitat on a ridge next to the village there that was outside of the park. But just because I knew all of those farmers and I knew they were interested in selling some of that property to the park, we could have pursued that and perhaps expanded Katenda Jerry Group home range a little bit. So there are some specific things like that. And on a larger scale, too, you know, there are, of course, some negative impacts of a tourism program like we created as well. Well, certainly the overwhelming opportunities there for people to have new jobs and to get more education and improve their standard of living in the local village are phenomenal. And when I returned, I saw great changes and great progress for people there, but also some negative impacts as well in the commercialism and inflation, and even things like an increase in AIDS in that village by the mere fact that more people are moving in and out and spreading mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you wish more people at large understood about conservation and preserving endangered species?
Well, what I would say to folks, too, and people here in the Northwest, is that if you look to our own situation here, if you pick up a newspaper, you know, you're very likely to read a story about the efforts to restore Puget Sound or save our endangered killer whales in Puget Sound or Chinook salmon that are throughout the rivers of the Northwest. And those issues of how to preserve wildlife in this more human-dominated world that we live within, Those issues are fundamental everywhere. They're really the same. So the creatures and the context may be different in a place like Uganda, but really the issue of how to preserve biodiversity in the face of expanding human needs and expanding human population, those issues transcend culture.
Why do you think we're so fascinated with gorillas?
Well, I think we are because if you're sitting out there in the pouring rain next to a group of gorillas and you've got your head in your hands and you're waiting for the rain to stop and you glance over, you might very well see a gorilla sitting there with his or her head in their hands waiting for the rain to pass too. We have so many similarities in behavior. I think we see so much of ourselves in them that they strike a particular chord with us.
Yeah. Did you ever misread their body language? Because I've only obviously seen them at the zoo. but in my observations at the zoo, they like to play act with people. I've seen them sitting there being all nonchalant, and then all of a sudden they'll charge at the window and bash on it, and then they saunter away. They're almost laughing at you.
Yes. They learn to tease, in a sense, they do. And I don't know if misreading the body language happened all the time, but it was very important to understand their dynamics among themselves, because they would use those same bits of language and whether it was vocalizations or body gestures towards us. And so we needed to know how to behave if we were going to play by the rules. Mm-hmm. They have very elaborate displays to establish and maintain hierarchies of dominance within a group, particularly among males, but for females too. And those displays, whether they're charging or pig grunting or just lunging at one another, are important to interpret correctly so you don't bring the whole thing crashing down upon you.
Yeah. Now, we're talking today, of course, about Tor Hansen's book, The Impenetrable Forest, My Gorilla Years in Uganda. This is a fabulous read. I learned so much about the history of Uganda, which, as I said to you before the show, was interesting to me because, as a little girl at that time and when all the Asians were flooding into Britain and other countries because they were outed by Idi Amin. And that the country today, Uganda, is still haunted by that to some extent, right?
Sure, there are still strong memories of the Amin years in Uganda. For example, when I was living with a Ugandan family during the training period, and if you were socializing with people at a local pub or at your home, you would walk people home in a group. It was very unusual and was considered quite rude not to walk somebody home because you didn't want people moving around after dark alone. Mm. And some of that is simply cultural, but it also was a reflection of the very real dangers to people during the years of Amin and his successor, predecessor and successor, Milton Obote, who was also responsible for terrible things there.
Right. Now, when you've lived there for 2 years and you came back to the States, did you come back to the States then?
I did, yes, yeah. After that.
Did you have a readjustment period there?
I'm probably still readjusting. Certainly there was culture shock coming back. In fact, oftentimes people will say that is even harder than making the adjustment to move abroad. But I do very much value the perspective that I gained by living in Uganda, appreciation for things that we have here and also appreciation for things there that we don't have that hopefully I can help share with people on this side.
Mm. Do you think it changed your perspective as a conservationist?
Absolutely. I'll tell you that it's easy to have a conservation ethic in a place like the States where many of us are lucky enough to have a good job and we're not necessarily struggling day to day to feed ourselves. But it's much more challenging to have a conservation ethic when you're living at the edge of a rainforest and your family relies on the tiny patch of beans and bananas that you're trying to grow. And, mm-hmm. and if a gorilla comes into that patch and destroys the bananas, it's not a loss to your pocketbook, it's a loss to your stomach.
Yeah.
And so I think that perspective has really opened my eyes to the importance of understanding conservation within the social and political context of the region, whether it's mountain gorillas or any species that we're working to save. We need to have compassion for the people as well as the animals.
Mm. Now, I know you're an award-winning poet. Did you write poetry while you were there too?
Well, I do write poetry regularly, so I had poetry in my journals as well as daily observations and as a part of them. And yes, certainly there were poems that came from that time.
Anything you want to share with us?
I don't know. Do I have a poem? Probably not. I could read you something from the book, but I don't have a poem off the top of my head.
Okay, no worries.
Okay.
I would have asked you that in the break, but we didn't have time.
Oh, no problem.
So tell us about the most recent work you've been doing, because I know you work on many different things.
I do. The most recent tropical work I was doing was in Central America, and it was studying the effects of habitat fragmentation on rainforest trees. And many of the questions that I find most compelling as a scientist lie at that interface, just like with gorillas and the people surrounding them, it lies at the interface between the natural world and the human world. And as we see our rainforest being split into smaller patches and separated by human habitation, I'm very curious to learn how those systems function and how we can best preserve biodiversity in that fragmented landscape, because that is becoming a very dominant landscape in regions throughout the world. And so what I was doing there was studying how populations of rainforest trees are affected and how we can maintain gene flow and pollination and seed dispersal in those areas.
Oh, interesting. Another book on the way on that?
We'll have to see. We'll have to see. Absolutely. I'm definitely interested in writing more books, so that maybe we'll get one out of that experience as well.
Mm. A big question, but what change would you like to see today? What do you think we need to really focus on?
In terms of conservation?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, a change that I would like to see. There are many things. I think fundamentally for me, and what I talk with people about is to make the realization that the decisions that we make as individuals, as well as a society, will really do matter and do affect what measure of biodiversity, what measure of the wonderful life that we have here on this planet that our generations will leave for those that follow. I think our actions as individuals are very important in that. So I always encourage people that, you know, their decisions in how they shop and how they live and how they drive and heat their homes may at times appear infinite in the face of our challenges, but in fact, it's the collection of all of those individual actions that will lead to significant change for us.
Yeah. I thank you so much for being with us today. I really thoroughly enjoyed your book and enjoyed talking with you today. I'm not sure if you have a website. I couldn't find one for you. Do you have one?
There's a website under construction. So right now the best website is to go to 1500books.com, and there's information there about the book and also about the book tour and other things as well. So that's the best one right now. It would be 1500books.com. That's the publisher.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Vicky. It's been a pleasure.
And my guest, of course, Dr. Tor Hansen, his book, The Impenetrable Forest, great read, My Gorilla Years in Uganda. Thanks to everyone for joining us today. You can find me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or through conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us today. We will be back next Monday at noon. And until then, live well, live strong, and thanks for being with us.
September 1st on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. What do you know about the sacred feminine, about goddess? Reverend Tate believes that raised feminine consciousness would lead to a better world, that resurrecting goddess would mean more joy, more compassion, less stress, and no war. Join us next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for Reverend Tate and the Sacred Feminine. That's Labor Day at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.